Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This episode of Politics Without the Boring Bits is sponsored by BT, because BT means business. BT knows that businesses come in many shapes, sizes, and guises, from the person just starting out at their kitchen table to the biggest employer, which is why no matter what line of work you're in, they've got your back to help you succeed and do what you do best. No doubt connectivity is a must in Westminster, and it certainly helped us to get this episode created and distributed to you listening right now. BT already connects more than 1 million businesses and public sector organisations, offering secure and reliable connectivity. Nearly three quarters of people running a business or side hustle feel they couldn't do so without reliable broadband and mobile connectivity. That's why having connectivity you can count on is a must for business, whether it be facilitating multiple devices being connected at once or making team calls or guest Wi-Fi access for customers. BT's connectivity helps keep you and your customers happy. Whatever your business, BT's got your back. Search BT's got your back.
Hello, welcome. Thank you for downloading. Sorry, it is still not Matt Chorley. It's still me, Luke Jones, sitting in. Don't worry, Matt's alive and well. He's sunning himself in the garden. He'll be back in front of your podcast microphone very soon. Today, we've got absolutely loads for you. We'll do Disunited Kingdom on this podcast. We'll take you around all the four corners of the UK, find out what is happening from journalists on their patches. And also, we're going to be hearing from Susan Mickey, another one of our pre-pandemic profs. We've been profiling some of the experts who we hear all the time on the airwaves to tell us what on earth they were doing before the pandemic, because it turns out they had careers before COVID. And mighty interesting careers they were. She's currently director of the Centre for Behavioural Change. First, though, our columnist. Here's Robert Crampton and Angela Epstein. We're thinking about first date stories at the moment, because you might have seen Keir Starmer on Piers Morgan's Life Stories last night talking about how he met his wife, and she put the phone down on him. He was trying to organise a date for months, and eventually she said, "All right, I'll go out with you." Oh, I feel like Ken Bruce. Robert Crampton and Andrew Epstein, our columnists, are here. Morning, both.
Morning, Luke.
Thank you very much for joining us. Either of you got a very good first date story, Robert, Angela, maybe how you met your partners or previous lovers?
Well, lovers. Okay, so I met my husband when I was 18 years old, and we bumped into each other on a street corner. He was with somebody I knew, and da-di-da-di-da. We sort of were all, he was 3 years older than me, but we sort of all knew each other in my very exciting corner of North Manchester. And it was just after the A-level results came out, and his chat-up line was, "What did you get in your A-levels?"
Lovely.
Matched only by his proposal, which was, we were on and off for a few years. I'm sure readers are riveted by my love life. But when we finally sort of, you know, he decided he wanted to get married, he rang me up and he said, "I've been speaking to my parents. They think we should get married." So, you know, violins, rose petals. Nope, none of that. Thank you.
Just how's about it?
What can you expect from a chartered accountant? That's all I can say.
Oh, it's like a Richard Curtis movie. Robert, can you beat that?
Maybe. My wife and I were at school together, so we met even younger than 18. We met when we were 11.
Oh, gosh.
Wow.
We didn't start going out together, I hasten to add, until we were in our mid-20s, but we were friends in between. We met at the school youth club back 1976, I think. Mm. I was playing table football, which I knew how to play because I'd played it a bit in France on holiday. My wife, who didn't know how to play, anyway, just came along and told me what we should be doing and organised the whole thing, and she's been pretty much doing that ever since.
It was a bit like that bit in Ghost where Patrick Swayze helps her sort of do the posture. Was it like that, but your wife helping you with the table football?
Well, yeah, I mean, she thought she was helping
reaching round from behind you to sort of do the...
Yes, I was actually the one who knew what I was doing, but that didn't stop her then, and it hasn't since.
Marvellous. Well, 87222 if you want to text us. Start your message with the word Times. You can tweet us at Times Radio. How You Met Your Lover, a story better than Keir Starmer's on how he met his wife, according to what he told Piers Morgan last night. Right, both of you, let's get on with the business of the day. Vaccine confidence. This morning, the UK government has been hosting a global summit on vaccine confidence because there are some parts in the UK where vaccine take-up has faltered. I mean, we had those pictures of Twickenham and people 18 and up sprinting to try and get a vaccine. But in places, some parts of Scotland, that there's still some worry that people might, younger generations aren't as keen. Are you worried about that, Angela?
I'm concerned that because the vaccine, as far as we understand it, is the best way to get out of or to at least manage the epidemic and or the pandemic rather. And obviously the Vaccine Confidence Project is going to try and address the public concerns in order to sort of improve vaccine coverage. Now I've got a little bit of skin in the game here because and sorry to sound like the typical proud mother, but my eldest son is a young doctor, junior doctor, and he was chucked in on the front line back in March last year when COVID was just this unknowable thing. Yeah. And even the consultants didn't know what they were doing. And, I chat to him a lot about this, and he just gives me the information. And obviously, there's all the great and good and the really important talking heads that are on the telly that tell us all the data. But the upshot is that you talk to anybody who's managed the horrible sides of COVID, and they'll tell you, why would you even risk it? So we've obviously got an issue. And I think part of the problem is that there are the classic vaccine refuseniks, and unfortunately I know some of them, who do sort of trot the line out about, well, we don't know what it is. Is it poison? Is it the new thalidomide? And all those kind of, they are ridiculous conversations because thalidomide was an entirely different kind of situation. But then we have to sort of sensitively look at the demographic of those who are shirking the vaccine, certain communities, certain ideas, and we need those who are influential within those areas to speak out and advocate, because otherwise it just becomes like a self-fulfilling prophecy and people will just not go near it, and that we have to be vaccinated. Otherwise what happens is the disease stays within the community. The vaccine is only 90% successful, so there's going to be a 10% risk anyway. The vulnerable will be exposed. Ultimately, hospital admissions will go up. And then we're on that horrible road that we're all so pig sick of. So we have to encourage the vaccine.
Pig sick is exactly the word for it. But Robert, I'm surprised by, because as Angela was saying, you think of vaccine refuseniks and you think of strange people who live in the internet. But actually, I was having dinner with someone the other day, and she's in her late 20s, a friend of mine, and I was surprised where she said, she's a really clever person, but she said, I'll have the vaccine, but I mean, I won't be desperate to get it. I mean, I'll probably get it, but I'm not mega keen. And I just could not get my head round it. So there's that kind of low-level ambivalence, isn't there, which is plaguing.
Yeah, I've come across the same thing amongst everyone of my generation. I'm 56 and older, has had it no problem. But amongst my younger friends, people in their 20s, 30s and 40s, I've also been surprised, given that I think they're sensible people, that they're not in any rush to have it. They don't have any, they're not conspiracy theorists. They don't think it's, you know, they're being injected with, you know, Microsoft programs or anything. They just think, well, this isn't really a priority for me. And I think I can sort of see where they're coming from, but I can also feel a rising tide of frustration and anger, not least in myself, that this will lead to they're not going to die, but they could end up in hospital, and the NHS has got more than enough to do trying to start working through the backlog of non-COVID patients. So, and it could also, as Angela suggested, it could also mean that the restrictions end up not being lifted for a while longer. And I think there could be a real backlash against that view. I mean, the vast majority of people who are ill with COVID now are under 50s who have not been vaccinated, which just is proof positive that the vaccine works. But some people think I can't avoid the conclusion that there's a minority, but a fairly large minority of people in society who are pretty selfish.
Definitely.
They don't really sort of care too much, and which is why we have laws, really, because most of us are law-abiding, and the laws that exist are there to prevent the small minority behaving badly.
But don't you think also? I mean, I agree with Robert. Isn't it awful when your guests agree with each other?
That's nice.
I agree with everything. Bye. what he just said. Yeah. No, but also the thing is that there's a very liberal anti-vaccine passport conversation. And I understand the whole issue about, you know, all the cliches come marching out about nanny state and surveillance culture and all that kind of thing. But we embrace vaccinations when it suits. And this is why Robert's so right about the selfishness issue. If you want to travel to certain countries, and they say you've got to have a hepatitis injection or you've got to have a typhoid injection, and you want that longer awaited trip to wherever it is, you know, I'm talking about pre-lockdown times when we used to be able to travel. You did it because you thought, I'm going to do it. You didn't start raging about these are my human rights being compromised because I've been, you did it when, sorry to drop the young doctor thing again. You know, when my son started medical school, it's, you got to have these injections. You're going to be, and any of these healthcare courses, it's not just medicine, all of them, you've got to have certain injections because you're going to interface with patients. We do it. We do it because self-interest is king. And that's the whole problem, is because we've got no way of policing it. And believe me, I'm not a raving fascist who's trying to advocate a police state, but because they're over, despite what my husband said, but because we are, Rita, I married him, but because we are not trying, because there's no way of enforcing it, and enforcement is such a dangerous word, but because everything's open to everybody, regardless of your vaccination status, then how else do you encourage it? So the only way you can do it is try to get the public the awareness, the healthcare message across. But I think because COVID, so many people are asymptomatic, because as Robert rightly says, you know, they go on about their business. It doesn't bother me. And I do think also, I mean, I've seen it in, you know, I'm part of the Orthodox Jewish community. I've seen it in, it happens in the Asian community. There are certain communities where there is vaccine skepticism. And we have to try and address that and encourage the confidence for people to accept that this is a good thing.
And then we should say, meanwhile, as we had the other day at Twickenham, there was a sea of 18 and above absolutely legging it in some parts across London to get there. And in fact, after that, I had serious... I was tempted to go... I haven't been vaccinated yet. And the next two stages, because they're doing them in two-year blocks, aren't they? So I'm 27, so I think the next I'll be the next stage after next. Anyway, I was getting serious FOMO.
27? I've got dresses that are older than you.
But I was getting serious FOMO, and I was annoyed that I didn't leg it to Twickenham. So yesterday, I was about to take myself off for a walk, and it was sort of near 6 o'clock time, and I thought, oh, this is when vaccine centres are closing, aren't they? And you hear all those stories about, we've got leftovers, come and get your jabs and everything. So I got one of those rental bikes and did a little tour of, I found out where three vaccine centres were near me, and I went around each one. I went to one, left a name and a number. At 7 o'clock, they called me back. I went... I sat there for 30 minutes and then the woman came out and she said, I'm so sorry, this never happens, but we have completely used up every dose. There's no half-open vials. We've, like, done the maths perfectly.
Yeah.
But she said, come back tomorrow, so today, at 7, and we'll try again and you'll be top of the list. So,
is that Pfizer or AstraZeneca?
It'll be Pfizer. But literally, the advice is get on your bike. I rode around London in a mad sweat.
Luke, I think the vast majority of 27-year-olds are like you. I don't want to demonise young people. We're talking about a small percentage, but a significant percentage of people who haven't yet quite got the message that they need to get this done, as Angela rightly says, so we squeeze the virus out of society, so it isn't just hanging about making our lives a misery for an indefinite period of time.
Let's talk about, I was going to say something a bit more cheery, but actually this is just expensive holidays when you boil it down. Let's worry about PCR tests and how much they cost. Grant Shapps on this very network not too long ago was saying he was driving down the cost of PCR tests that you need before and after you go to even green list countries, let alone just amber list countries, and which the consumer group have warned today that holiday makers could miss out on their trips not only because of the cost, but actually because of some of these private companies doing the tests are struggling to return the tests on time. Yeah. And this is even though actually there's only a sort of handful of countries that you should technically be going on holiday to at the moment. Angela, what do you make of this? Because the green list is going to expand soon.
Well, I certainly hope so. I mean, it's interesting, the one of your rivals, the Mail, have got a campaign urging the Treasury to axe VAT on the so-called, you know, the gold standard PCR tests. And that would at least help, you know, slash the cost of these, because it is astronomical. And if you quite rightly want to go on a holiday, you're a family of four, you want to go with whomever, you want to treat your parents who you haven't seen for ages, you know, the cost, the additional cost is going to be significant. My son, I haven't got hundreds of children, by the way.
I was going to say, how many children have you got?
My name is Von Trapp. Epstein is my pseudonym.
You have a whole critical care unit staffed by your offspring.
Correct. But this one did history. You're all right. But he needed a same day PCR test, and for something. And you know, we were firing out. We were looking on the internet, and the cost was just spiraling. And in the end, we found one, and it was £140. That was just for one person, and that was a same day. You know, the travel industry has suffered. The consumers have suffered. Our mental health has suffered because we've not had the freedom to go away. And I know there are lots of very important things out there too. But I think the fact is that at the moment it's going to become so significantly expensive to do anything, even if they do expand the green list, which in itself is a nonsense. And my favourite joke, I can't claim, although I am claiming it, is the kind of what I call the ambiguity list.
Yes, lovely.
Yeah.
Nice. There was a headline the other day that was Amber Gambler, which I quite liked as well, of people heading out there. Robert, when you read all these stories, is it putting you off the idea of leaving the British Isles at any point this summer?
It is a little bit, actually. Yeah, I mean, it's significant cost. I mean, if you're looking... You're looking at maybe £1,000 for a family of four. And other than that, I mean, I've got some friends who just come back from Portugal, and they say there's various, I mean, I hesitate to call them scams, but there's you know, that in order to get their test to come back from Portugal, they said, well, that would be whatever it was, €200 or €300. Oh, and if you want it translated into English, that would be another €100. So...
And you're stuck if you're coming back. You think, yeah, you've think got to get it done. You're in Portugal, so they can charge what they like.
I think, yes, there's a certain advantage being taken. And, I mean, the idea that there's VAT on them is obviously a nonsense. I mean, that would help to get rid of that.
But we have to take away this idea that going on holiday is a gamble. And I thought what we need is certainty. So green list, yes. Red list, no. We tried to go to Tenerife at Christmas time, and suddenly, I don't know if you remember, but Britain was thrust on the no-go for anything under Spanish jurisdiction. And we'd paid for, I mean, I don't expect you to get the string quartet out for us, but we paid for PCR tests. And it's simply not fair. I mean, I know in France, French nationals, the government pays for them if you want to travel abroad. I think the easier thing is to embrace certainty. So can you go or can you not? Then if you can go, are you vaccinated? How many PCR tests will the lateral flow do? Because otherwise, you know, there's a fantastic industry out there, which is, and it can't even keep up anyway. But it's not fair. We've had ambiguity for too long, and we need to know where we stand on all this.
Very finally, both of you, did either of you see Keir Starmer on Piers Morgan last night on Life Stories?
I didn't, I'm afraid. I've read about it, but I didn't see it.
What about you, Angela?
I saw a bit, but I decided to go and watch The Sound of Music instead. I mean, it had everything. It had, you know, I'm not undervaluing the fact that, you know, the stuff about his parents was awful. But, you know, the fact his mother was so seriously ill, the fact his dad died, that his family dog was killed in a fire. Yeah. It seemed to be like one thing after another. There was some ludicrous stuff. Was he the inspiration for Bridget Jones's Mark Darcy? I really hope not. Otherwise, I'm going to have to take a travel pill if I watch that one again.
All in fact. Well, Richard Curtis, speaking to Mariella Frost a little bit later on, didn't he write the screenplay for Bridget Jones? I think he did. Well, anyway, we can ask him, because he's friends with Helen Fielding, isn't it? So we can get Mariella to ask him that. But what do you make of that, of this genre, Robert? It's the politician trying to do the personal, professional interview.
We all bemoan it, and we think, we wish it didn't happen, and the politics was more serious and not about personalities and so on. But it's just the way things are, and... He needs to catch a break. He needs, the British public has not warmed to him for whatever reason, and I don't suppose he wanted to do it, but he's trying his best to advance the cause of his party. So I came away, I think, well, you know, well done. You know, I sort of slightly warmed to him for doing it, because God knows I'm sure he didn't want to, but he's doing his best. Yeah, he's doing his best. And the stuff about his dad, I thought, was interesting. I think probably a lot of people could probably relate to that. So,
and we might not like it, Angela, but even though we would like everything to be done on policies and manifesto pledges, actually a lot of it is just down to, well, do you like them or not? What do you make of them?
I agree. I absolutely agree. On that level, yes. And why did Blair enjoy such a, you know, historic sweep to victory and such so much time in office? Was because people enjoyed everything that he, you know, he had this tactical glottal stop where he'd say the way he spoke, and he had a young family, and we loved all that, and it spoke to us, and it wasn't, you know, old men in bad raincoats anymore. But Keir Starmer, and I agree, and he's only a human being, he's a real person, and I get all of that. I think the issue has been that he's got this robot image, and that needs to be dispelled. But equally, we need a very effective opposition who tell us what they stand for. He is very likeable, you know, when you look at him on a personal level, and this was a personality test. I'm not sure I particularly enjoy this kind of whole hair shirt, let me tell you about how I got trashed with George Clooney stuff, because it just feels a bit tactical and forced. I think when you're a big personality and you've got an engaging personality, it comes across, you know, love or hate Boris, whatever your views are on it. He doesn't need to do a personality to show us who he was. You know, there are other ways of doing it. And my beef with Keir Starmer, I mean, you know, I like him on lots of levels. I'm still trying to get over the fact that he would have served under Corbyn had Corbyn won, and the stance that he took on things like anti-Semitism post facto, it worries me a little bit, because he would have swallowed it. But equally, we have to look forward, and you know, I want him to be good so that he can put this government to proof.
Robert Crampton and Angela Epstein. Next, one of our pre-pandemic profs.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Off Air, the podcast. With Jane Garvey and Fee Glover.
I go to the sink and I have some cheese.
You eat cheese in the sink?
Doesn't everybody?
Every Monday to Thursday, Jane and Fee keep the microphones on after their Times radio show.
I think if we were to do a Mr. and Mrs.
Oh,
no. How would that go in the booth?
Badly. It would go very badly.
Unencumbered and off air.
Two tiny women with gobs.
Off Air, the podcast. Now available on the Times radio app.
All this week, we've been profiling some of our favourite COVID experts. At the moment, they are never off our TV screens and radios and in our newspapers telling us what might happen with holidays and the like. Previously, we've heard from Linda Bold, Professor of Public Health at Edinburgh University, Danny Altman, who is a Professor of Immunology at Imperial College London. Today, Susan Mickey, Director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London.
Susan Mickey.
Sage's Professor Susan Mickey.
Professor Susan Mickey.
Susan Mickey from the Government Sage Advisory Group.
A member of the Behavioural Subcommittee of Sage and a member of the Independent Sage Committee. I spoke to her earlier, and she started off, first of all, by explaining what her role is as Director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London.
I'm a Professor of Health Psychology at University College London, and about 7 or 8 years ago, I thought it would be a really good idea to bring together lots of different people from different backgrounds to think about behaviour change, because it's a complicated issue, and no one academic discipline has got all the answers. And so that's where I set up the Centre for Behaviour Change. We do consultancy, we have a master's course, we do research, so very varied.
And in terms of your own career, can I rewind right back to the beginning? And in fact, maybe before the beginning, I'm interested, your parents in particular were absolute giants of science. And I wonder if the job you're doing now is a direct result of knowing what they did and maybe being inspired by that.
Yes, my mother was a reproductive biologist, an embryologist, and in fact did all the work underpinning IVF. So, she did the science that allowed that clinical procedure to develop. And my father, he was one of the very early people in the world who was developing artificial intelligence and thinking about how this could be applied to robots. So I was brought up in a household where there was a lot of curiosity about things, a lot of discussion about ideas, and I'm sure that led me in a sort of scientific route. As a child, I remember reading a book about what it was like to be schizophrenic and being really impressed sort of by what happens to the brain when it goes wrong, and thinking about how one could get better understanding to help.
So psychology, from an early age, you were thinking, this is what I'm interested in?
Yeah, from 18 years, I became interested in psychology. So I went to university and read psychology. And at the end of that, I thought, well, I've read lots of books and heard lots of lectures, but I really want to find out how to apply this to make things better. So I then did clinical psychology for 2 years, became a qualified clinical psychologist. This was at the Institute of Psychiatry in South London. I did my training. But after that, I thought, well, a lot of this is based on research, and I want to get an independent research training so I can really evaluate the research, because I'm doing all these therapies that are underpinned by evidence, but I wasn't confident that I could really evaluate that evidence. So I went back to the university that I'd my undergraduate degree in, and did a PhD. I'd always been really interested in children, looking at 3, 4, and 5-year-olds and how they think about number and how they solve problems.
Gosh.
And then after that, I then sort of combined all of that. So my first job was actually working in a joint NHS social services centre, working with children on the at-risk register, and actually working with families, working to try and keep children with families so that they could develop the skills and the understanding to be able to kind of care that was needed for those children.
In that job that you mentioned, did it seem like effective work you were doing with those families? Could you see benefits? Could you see change from what you were doing with them?
A dear friend of mine used to refer to psychologists like me as the sticking plaster brigade. going around putting little bits of sticking plaster on these big wounds that were being caused by other things. So I think one of the things that actually I find really impressing about the job was just knowing the incredible financial and housing and social challenges that people had. And, we were a sort of drop in the ocean, a very important drop. But I still felt it's a bit like running up an escalator going down.
You then moved on, correct me if I'm wrong, to working with health staff themselves, health practitioners, is that right? And helping them and working with them in terms of the problems that arose out of their work.
Yes. I then went to work at the Royal Free Hospital to begin with, again, working with patients of various kinds. Mm. But then it became obvious that actually a lot of the staff were very stressed, and they were often absent for psychological reasons. So a job was sort of created for me there, which was doing some work in the occupational health unit, so working with staff. And I developed three ways of working. I saw individual staff, and often I saw them when problems at work were coinciding with problems at home. And so there wasn't any bit of their life that was strong. But I also noticed that we were getting a lot of referrals from certain parts of the hospital, certain departments more than others. And I could see that actually part of that was due to management not being better,
really?
Communication not being better. And so I set up a lot of training for senior managers, because if they could, in a way, do their job better, it had knock-on effects for so many other staff.
And interesting now, I guess, looking at what's happening with us and has been happening in our hospitals during some of the more testing times of this pandemic.
It's been huge. I mean, obviously the NHS was under-resourced before this pandemic came along, and, you know, a lot of evidence from NHS staff that they were feeling supported and sufficiently resourced and really struggling, a lot of people leaving the professions. Then the pandemic came along, you know, and made it so much worse. So people have been really, really suffering in a huge way. And really, the government needs to put a large amount of resource into supporting staff.
You moved back into research, into academia, if these are the right words that I'm using, at King's College London, and looking at genetic counselling. What exactly is that?
Yeah, so this was a programme of work that was looking at the psychological aspects of the new genetic tests that were coming along. So, for example, people from families where breast cancer was generation after generation were able to test to find out, did they have the gene that would make them very likely to have breast cancer or not? But obviously, it has a lot of repercussions for people. So we were looking at aspects of that. And with genetic counselling, this was really how health professionals were talking to patients about genetics, about risk, about what it meant for themselves, what it means for their family members, because it's quite a complicated subject, and how one communicates complicated medical information can make a big difference to people's response, both emotionally, so in terms of their behaviour.
And pre-pandemic, when you were thinking about all of these things, what was your understanding of the extent to which this could be useful? Of course, lots of the campaigns around getting people to stop smoking has been quite successful. Think, you know, like away from healthcare, you know, this kind of behavioural policy to do with carrier bags has been quite, single-use plastic carrier bags have been quite useful. But what did you think the extent of its utility was?
Well, I was actually on SAGE, the Scientific Advisory Group in Emergencies, in 2009.
Way before it was fashionable.
Yeah, swine flu. I don't know if you remember swine flu or the H1N1 pandemic, which, thank goodness, wasn't as bad as had been feared. But I was the only social or behavioural scientist on that group at that time. And, you know, as now, I could completely see that actually people's behaviour is what causes transmission, and changing people's behaviour is what can break transmission and reduce the pandemic. So I persuaded the committee to set up a specific behavioural, we called it the behaviour and communication subgroup back then, which I chaired over that period, and then ended up doing quite a bit of research in terms of how best to communicate again about pandemics, and especially about risk, you know, what it means for people to feel they're at risk or not. So I then, at that point, with a colleague, James Rubin, we began looking at the Department of Health. They had a weekly tracker measuring, you know, attitudes and emotional response and various kinds of behaviours. And then in doing that, we realised that actually this data was really important, but actually could be massively improved. So we got a research grant as part of a whole suite of research grants that were funded after 2009, and we were able to pilot it, develop the measures, get ethics approval, and then they're all frozen for when the next pandemic came along. So what it meant was when this pandemic came along at the beginning of last year, all of those were unfrozen, and we were able to get going immediately, you know, doing our weekly surveys instead of waiting 6 months to do all the procedures needed to get the ethics approval. So that's been a really, really useful and gratifying, you know, that we were able to do that. So we've been advising the government and their communications based on the data we've been collecting. I can't say that they've always got it right, but at least we've been trying.
Yeah. And it's interesting. So your story and also some of the other people that I've spoken to for this series of interviews, it's interesting that what you're talking to us about now on the radio, on the television, in the newspapers is obviously you have the benefit of absolutely years and years and years and decades of, in some cases, of research into this area and the rest of it. However, this time, the scrutiny of what you're doing and what you're saying is absolutely incredible. And I wonder how you found that all of a sudden when you say something, it can immediately become a news story in itself. It can change what's running in people's radio bulletins or TV bulletins.
I think in general, scrutiny is a good thing. I think if anything, the SAGE and the government in general should have been much more transparent much earlier on. I think public accountability is very good. And I think some of the things that have happened haven't had that degree of transparency. However, that's a rather different thing than when one's words are twisted or one sees things made about what one has done in one's life or not done. And that is not only personally unpleasant, but I think it's actually socially irresponsible because it undermines trust in science unnecessarily. And obviously undermining trust in science is not helpful when, you know, we are, as even the government says it's trying to do, you know, base policy and practice on what works, which is basically what science is looking at.
What are your hobbies, Professor Mickey, away from all of this?
Hobbies? Well, I have 4 grandchildren and all quite young, between 3 months and 5 years old. And with two of my 3 children have produced those 4 wonderful grandchildren. So they're a huge hobby and absolutely delightful to see them growing up. Adore spending time with them. I love walking, playing tennis, do yoga every morning, do cryptic crosswords, read novels, and think the sorts of things that a lot of people enjoy doing. And I find actually between work and those things and seeing my friends, I mean, seeing obviously is a thing I enjoy hugely. There's not a lot of time left over. I do love traveling, but I kind of forgotten what that's like. I hope one day to pick that up again.
Bless you. The things you've just said are things which have been borderline illegal for the past year, seeing your grandchildren, seeing your friends and traveling.
well, traveling's been off. I mean, seeing grandchildren in parks has been lovely. Yes. At the moment, a lot of these things, actually the walking, the crosswords, the yoga, etc., things can all be done in locations. But I desperately hope that we will not have to go through another of those.
Professor Mickey, thank you so much for your time. It was a fascinating insight into your work.
My pleasure.
That was Susan Mickey, Director of the Centre for Behavioural Change at University College London. Tomorrow, we'll hear from another one. We're going to hear from Mike Tilsley, who is an infectious disease modeller, who will also tell us about some of the AMDRAM he does and Taekwondo. You don't want to miss that. Now, this United Kingdom.
From Land's End to John O'Groats, St David's to Southend-on-Sea, and Belfast to Bognor Regis. England, Wales, Scotland, Northern Ireland. This is Disunited Kingdom on Times Radio.
It's Disunited Kingdom, and hello to Luke Jacobs, editor at Kent Live in England. Hello.
Hi, Luke.
We've got Andy Phillip, political editor at the Press and Journal in Scotland. Morning, Andy.
Good morning.
And Liz Perkins, defence reporter at the South Wales Evening Post.
Hi there, how are you doing?
And Alison Morris, crime correspondent at the Belfast Telegraph. Hi, Alison.
Morning.
Thank you all so much for giving up part of your very sunny morning this Wednesday. Let's start with you, Luke, in England. Take us through your patch. What's concerning you? Something COVID-flavoured first, I think.
Yeah, so, of course, what we've seen over the last few weeks with the potential threat to the lockdown easing on June the 21st is the spread of this new variant, which is the so-called India variant. And it's something that hasn't necessarily affected us disproportionately in Kent. Of course, we've seen it's affected the kind of the northwest of England more so. We did, of course, have the Kent variant, or the so-called Kent variant, at the sort of end of last year, which kind of drove the last lockdown. But we have actually seen a cluster actually in Canterbury, which of course is our university city. Kind of the postcodes that are affected are the ones that tend to have the most university students. And yesterday they announced, or the council announced, that there was going to be some surge testing. So they're very keen not to call it surge testing. Essentially, there will be some testing centres being opened, walk-in centres where people can go and see whether they've they have this new variant, essentially. And it's a way of kind of trying to crack down on it. But the council are trying to reassure people here that it isn't of any particular concern. And it's very much about kind of trying to isolate where this is affecting certain parts of Kent. So it's something to keep an eye on for sure. But there is no real signs that there is a potential kind of surge of people being affected by this particular variant. But of course, we'll see what the testing figures come back with. But we did have a reporter up there yesterday at the briefing. The new director of public health, as I say, was very reassuring and made it very clear that there aren't a disproportionate number of cases of this new variant. But of course, it's something that the whole country is kind of keeping an eye on as we edge closer to June the 21st.
But around the UK, numbers are up at least a bit. And Andy, at the Press and Journal, yesterday we heard from Nicola Sturgeon at that press conference. There was, you know, she was echoing some concerns from some experts that were at the start of a third wave.
Yes, that's right. There's a bit of a change of mindset needed to sort of deal with the changing nature of how we're looking at the number of cases compared with the number of people going to hospital or even dying now. So the First Minister, Nicola Sturgeon, has been talking more about how the chain appears to be broken more now between catching the virus and then having the vaccine in the way, which is possibly stopping the more serious consequences of COVID. But we're watching the country open up to some places like the Scottish Islands and the Western Isles and Northern Isles moving down to level zero, which is symbolically quite a big thing.
Yeah.
But with everything opening up, we're also hearing the National Clinical Director, Jason Leach, talk about, well, it's maybe at the start of a third wave, other experts also talking about how, you know, we have to be cautious. But it's hard to see how the general public then translate those warnings into being given permission effectively to go and do loads more, go out and meet huge groups. We can all sit inside the pub now in everywhere in Scotland, you know, for to varying degrees. So it's really now kind of a waiting game. And don't forget, there's going to be a fan zone apparently opened in the middle of Glasgow as well, with the Euros taking place in just a few days. So we've got quite a lot of anxious officials, I think, looking at the numbers while the politicians are also having their own argument in the background. Yesterday, the opposition parties talking about how, you know, nearly 3 million Scots are still in limbo because they're still restricted by level two. So a whole city like Glasgow, which has been under the longest of all the higher restrictions, finally moving down from three to two, which at a practical level means adult outdoor contact sports and being able to go indoors for hospitality and cafes and pubs. They're talking about how more targeted measures need to be implemented now, rather than even those blanket measures, which is effectively, you know, we're nowhere near lockdown when you're at level two.
Yeah.
So it really is a bit of a waiting game now, I think.
Liz, at the South Wales Evening Post, tell us about the situation in Wales, because we keep being told around the UK that the answer to managing COVID in the future is really good contact tracing and testing. And the Welsh Government have announced that Test Trace Protect, that service is going to be extended for quite a long while.
Yeah, I've got to say, I mean, Wales has been doing incredibly well in terms of this crisis. I mean, we've got about 1.1 million people who've been vaccinated in Wales. So it means that there's 35.5% who are fully vaccinated. And it seemed that things are going great. And now we've got an unfortunate situation in Connoy where they've got cases of the Indian variant. I mean, 35 cases doesn't seem a lot. And they're concentrated on Llandudno Junction and Penrhyn Bay. But the reality is that this cluster is heading towards community transmission. And that's obviously caused major concern with Eluned Morgan, the Welsh Health Minister, as to, you know, really people need to go out and get tested, even if they don't have symptoms, because clearly, I mean, that is going to cause major problems for the rest of Wales if that's not properly contained.
And Alison, move us on to Northern Ireland. Your crime correspondent at the Belfast Telegraph. But just what is the COVID situation in Northern Ireland at the moment? What's the thing which is concerning people most?
Well, I mean, the vaccination programme here has been working really fast. I mean, at this stage last week, they put out a call for over 18s to start booking their vaccination if they wanted to, because there was extra vaccine left over. We have very low cases. I think there's something like 58 positive tests yesterday, and there hasn't been any deaths away. There has been a few. Indian variant has been located in Northern Ireland. I think at this stage it's, you know, in very low double figures. But we were at this place last summer, and so people, you know, and then we ended up going to a second wave, so people are still being cautious. But this week the Orange Order have announced that the 12th, which was cancelled last year, all the marches were cancelled because of COVID, will go ahead. So there's a sign that nature's healing, is it not? We're going to have Orange Order parades in July again. I think that, you know, people are hopeful that the vaccine is going to be the game changer and we're not going to go back into another wave. But we always have to be cautious, because we were right down to single hospital admissions last August, you know, September. And then by December and January, the hospitals were completely overwhelmed. So nobody wants to go back into that. We know it's a winter virus, so it's easy to get complacent when we're all outdoors enjoying ourselves in the summer. But I think, you know, the health minister is urging caution, you know, especially around large gatherings.
Alison, moves on to something a little bit more politics flavoured. Edwin Poots, the new DUP leader, how's he bedding in? When's he going to announce some ministers?
What a week we have had for politics here, I can tell you. Last week, the DUP met in a hotel in Belfast, which should have been a rubber stamping exercise to ratify the new leader, Edwin Poots, and instead it turned into probably an hour of the most gripping political theatre I have seen in a long time. So former leader Arlene Foster, along with MP Sir Geoffrey Donaldson and several other senior party members, walked out of the meeting before Edwin Poots had even made his maiden speech. Outside, several, you know, a senior party member from Fermanagh resigned at the treatment of Arlene Foster. Then MP Lee Jr. showed up and said that he knew all about, you know, when a leader was ousted and his father, it had hastened his death in the way he was removed from the DUP. This was all just meant to be, you know, ratify the leader. He makes a speech, everyone claps and we all go home. So the ministers were meant to be announced yesterday. He still hasn't announced. The Arlene Foster has said if he changes the ministerial team now, she'll resign and she'll leave the party and all sorts of other drama. So we're probably going to get them either, you know, the new ministerial team out at the end of this week or the start of next week. Most interestingly, while Edwin Poots wanted to be leader of the DUP, he does not want to be first minister, and he's going to appoint someone else to be first minister, probably the MLA Paul Girvan, who he's probably the reason Stormont, you know, collapsed, the sort of straw that broke a camel's back. He removed a £50,000 Irish language bursary for school children going to the Gaeltacht, and that was when Sinn Féin walked out of the Assembly a few years ago. Yeah, so, you know, that's going to be interesting to see what happens there. But my goodness, I mean, if you ever want to see drama, you've only got to look at what's going on in the DUP right now. I mean, there is a split right down the middle of that party.
Drama indeed. Luke, Kent Live, tell us about what we've been, all of us have been enjoying the sunny weather in most parts of the UK at the moment. But one of the sad things we've come to realise over the past few years is that good weather does usually equal more migrant crossings across the channel, which obviously is incredibly dangerous. And have you seen that spike over the bank holiday weekend?
Yeah, absolutely, Luke. Yeah, we saw around 600 crossings over the bank holiday weekend. And as you mentioned there, we saw a record high last year during the summer, of course, and that came during the pandemic and during lockdown, of course, when, you know, we were all shut inside our homes and we were able to, there was a bit more focus on this at the time. But I think it's probably key to point out that there are two aspects to this. There, There's the issue of crossings when it comes to trafficking and slavery as well, along those lines. And that's probably the backdrop to the government's new plan for immigration, which has actually come under fire, of course, from many people locally when it comes to refugee groups here and refugee action groups locally here in Kent, who believe that it actually makes it harder for asylum seekers to come here and to seek asylum. It appears to ring true when you see the numbers which aren't particularly coming down, which of course the government would say that's the reason why they do need to overhaul the system. But you know, when you do see the crossings increase like this, and when you do consider that many of these people, and it's really, really important to point out that they are people as well as people who are in kind of desperate need of a new home, they themselves are victims, and it's I think it's important to, of course, to remember that when they do arrive here, you know, what happens to them and what is their destination. And I think people locally tend to become worried that will they stay here? Will they settle here? Of course, we have a holding centre, Napier Barracks, which over the last few months has become a bit of a lightning rod for action, for instance. Yeah. Only recently, in fact, over the weekend, there was a very, very small protest near the port in Dover from those who perhaps believe that the problem of immigration is something that isn't perhaps being tackled. And I use the word problem there because that's the word that they would use. So you're seeing these issues conflating. So it'd be interesting to see what the government's immigration overhaul, what that does to these numbers. And of course, you know, what happens to people when they do arrive here on these shores, and you know, the humanitarian aspects of that. You know, what, you know, are they sent back, to use that phrase, or do you know, are they allowed to settle here regardless of whatever route they've come here? And the overriding kind of message from kind of the refugee local refugee action groups here is, you know, what are the safe and legal routes?
There
appear to be any that have been established. Of course, you will have these crossings because there are people trying to circumvent the actual, you know, the kind of the legal ways of getting here. And if there aren't any kind of legal ways of coming here, then of course you're going to see these this increase in the number of crossings, particularly, of course, when it comes to warmer weather. So it's an ongoing issue. It's something very much that the people locally are aware of, particularly in our kind of coastal towns. I'm thinking here, as I say, of Dover and Folkestone. But there is a kind of, as I say, it's against the backdrop of many people who do want to help, but just don't know how.
Thanks for bringing our attention to that, Luke. Andy at the Press and Journal, of course, our headlines here on Times Radio this morning have been busy with catch-up teaching and learning for pupils in England, but in Scotland, obviously, there's still a debate and an issue with the appeals process for exams, for the hires and others. What's happening with that?
Well, the Deputy First Minister, John Swinney, was in charge of Education in Scotland up until the election. He weathered a few pretty tricky storms with the way that exams were handled in the previous school year. The whole system, I think Scotland was the first, but the similar kind of problem happened in England as well, I think, where initial grades were judged to have been pretty unfair in the way they were awarded. It caused all kinds of trauma. It was it appeared to penalise pupils from poorer backgrounds, and teachers eventually were asked to just use their own judgment, which is what many of them had asked for in the first place. So there was a lot of unnecessary anguish for a lot of people, teenagers, enduring a pretty tough year already. The new education secretary is going to make a statement in a couple of hours at Scottish Parliament about the appeals process for hires, higher exams and national fives. So senior phase pupils haven't been able to sit their exams properly this year. But a lot of parents would say otherwise, and so would children, that these are exams in all but name. And essentially the new education secretary has got quite a job on her plate to explain how things are going to get better for young people in Scotland this year, because so far, teachers, parents and families have not been particularly happy with the way that they've been treated and the way that pupils are being asked to go about their work. But there's another thing happening at Parliament as well. Just while we were talking earlier, back to COVID, if I can, Douglas Ross, the leader of the Scottish Conservative Party, just in the past 10 minutes confirmed that he's self-isolating. So he had a close contact, apparently got a positive test. The interesting thing, of course, here is that he was in the Scottish Parliament this morning when he found out about that. So he had to sort of isolate in his office, and he's going to be staying in his Edinburgh hotel where he stays, because he's an MSP in the Highlands and Islands and represents Murray in my patch at Westminster. He's got two jobs. So this really illustrates the challenge that we're all facing now as more and more places open up and people travel around and come into contact with a lot of people potentially. So that's definitely one to watch there.
Across the UK, on DAB Digital Radio, on the free Times Radio app, and on your smart speaker, this is Times Radio.
Back to Luke Jones in for Matt Shawley. Disunited Kingdom continues, and I'd like some lighter stories from you all. Liz, I'm going to go for you first, because I saw this in the paper this morning. This sign in Carmarthen, which costs lots of money and is pants. Tell us about it.
You know what, as somebody who went over to LA to see the Hollywood sign, we were kind of sold this idea that this is what we were going to get outside Carmarthen. So I was quite excited.
Why would they set it up for a fail like that by saying it's going to be like the Hollywood sign?
Well, exactly. I mean, you know, we've all head over to LA just to see it, and you're just thinking, oh, wow, it would be fantastic. So the council spent £136,000 on recreating that, but for Carmarthen. And sadly, tragically, it does not look at all like it. I've seen both signs, and the problem is when you drive past the Carmarthen one, it's just blink and you miss it. And it was all meant to be about promoting the town, so tourists who headed down to Pembrokeshire, they would see this and obviously pop into Carmarthen. But now they're just seeing nothing. It's there. They're not going to move it, even though it's not as anticipated. They are going to make slight changes, but it's not really going to be the talk of Britain, sadly.
Just describe it, because we can all picture in our minds the Hollywood sign, but the Carmarthen one, just describe it.
It's kind of like more of a bronze sort of colour. It's quite slight, actually, and it's almost created like a wave, and it's almost too far back off the road. The Hollywood one is on the hill, and you can see it, but it's literally...
This is on the A40.
Yeah. And it's just when you come off onto a bypass, it's just literally there. So you have no time to look at it because you're too busy looking at the traffic heading behind you and just, you know, trying to peel out to that junction. And the people who are actually coming past there, they're going at such a speed that they're heading towards a roundabout. They have no time to look at it. So it just seems like such a waste of money.
Alison, this pandemic, if it's taught us anything, it's taught us that so many people love wild swimming and sea swimming, but they also love talking about it. And that's causing issues in Northern Ireland. For why?
Yes, but do they love it? Do they really? You see, I can't get my head around it.
It's some kind
of
masochism, is it? Isn't it?
I don't get it. I don't understand. But yes, but I mean, I suppose it's good that it means that people are now more aware of the quality of the water, and the water's having to be tested to ensure it's safe for people to swim in it. But I mean, I don't know how many of you have ever been to Ireland, Northern Ireland in particular. It's gorgeous today, but in general, it is freezing here. And I mean freezing constantly and raining. I have a friend who paid £200 for some kind of dry robe type effort so that she could jump into freezing cold sea and then get out of it and wrap herself in this thing, and told me it would give me an enormous sense of well-being and I should try it. But I mean, I can assure you, as I keep telling her, sitting on the sofa with cheap Sauvignon Blanc watching Netflix gives me an enormous sense of well-being. Jumping in freezing cold oceans is not up there on my list of things to do before I die. And as you said, I mean, social media is full of them. You can't do it quietly. If you're going to do it, you have to tell the whole world that you've done it as well. It's these dawn swimmers then as well. Who gets up at that hour of the day to jump in the ocean? I don't know.
Well, anyone, hang on, before you explain the issue, Liz, Andy, Luke, any of you wild swimmers, and maybe in Northern Ireland you've done it? Any of you?
Not yet.
I think Alison might need to come over to Scotland, because I was just going to talk to you about that. A heated open air pool, which is just reopened after 2 years as well. This is the antidote.
So fancy.
29 degrees up near Aberdeen.
That's a bath. That's like swimming in soup.
Well, I mean, other people might point this out, but that's warmer than an Aberdonian's bath for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, it's great. And it's a beautiful Art Deco place. It's just opened after 2 years and everyone's away swimming in it. And by the sea, obviously you don't have to go in the sea at all anymore. And it is seawater heated.
But the issue is, if not just the temperature, about how clean it is. And Alison, the issue with this bathing water review is about water quality testing, isn't it? Because we're always being told that actually most of the places that you're swimming, it might not actually be good for you.
No, that's it. And the fact is that people haven't even thought about that. They've just decided they're going to get up at the crack of dawn and go around jumping in water without considering what else might be floating in the water alongside them.
Yeah, meanwhile,
a third wave of a pandemic based on some mad virus that's been picked up by people jumping in dirty water and hanging around with each other. But yeah, so, I mean, I suppose it's a good thing that it means people are going to be more aware of that. They're just going to have to be more testing of the water, and that can only be good for everyone and be good for the environment. But regardless of how clean they tell me it is, I'm not getting into it anyway, so it doesn't matter.
Someone else, move us along. Luke, tell us about this lorry park in Kent, the one which we've heard about at no end when we were talking about Brexit and the future relationship. But now there's another issue.
Absolutely. Just to pick up on that, actually, I'm totally with Alison, by the way, on world swimming. I cannot really attract it, but I'm sure I'll probably get there at some point. And you did ask for a lighter story, Luke, and I've actually got a literal one here for you, actually. This is the Brexit lorry park, as you say, off the M20 in Kent, which, of course, is due to hold so many lorries. And it actually is at the moment, because it is actually functioning as a COVID testing site for lorries that come over the port. It's been compared to Wembley Stadium, and I mean, I'm looking forward to Euro 2020 tournament this summer after a year's worth of delay. But this is being compared to Wembley in a perhaps negative way. Essentially, the lorries are parked up there overnight, and you can see it from miles off. There are so many lights on from the lorries, and also from the facility itself. It's according to residents around the actual lorry park itself, it's ruining their views, and of course it's keeping them up at night as well, because the light is shining through their windows. So it's an ongoing issue, perhaps not for the reason you'd expect, and we'll see whether they'll be able to dim those lights over the sort of coming weeks and months. The government have actually come back as well, because they're actually due to have actually publicly released the environmental impact, which is something you have to do when you apply for planning permission for something and before it's approved. They haven't actually released that publicly yet. And of course, people would expect this to have been included in that as well. But it doesn't appear to have seen the light of day, unfortunately, as yet. So,
well done. Finishing us off there with a literal lighter story and a lovely pun thrown in as well. Thanks very much, Luke. That's Luke Jacobs, editor of Kent Live. That's it for Disunited Kingdom. Thank you all. We've also heard from Andy Phillip, political editor at the Press and Journal in Scotland, Liz Perkins, defence reporter at the South Wales Evening Post, and Alison Morris, crime correspondent at the Belfast Telegraph, taking us around all four corners of the UK. Thank you very much to all the Disunited Kingdom journalists around the UK there we're hearing from. I'm Luke Jones. Thank you very much for downloading and for listening to this podcast and for making it to the end. A slap on the back for that. Do download tomorrow. We'll have loads more in store. We'll be talking about courts and all that has changed with them in the pandemic. And as I mentioned, another one of our pre-pandemic profs, Mike Tilsley, on Taekwondo, on Amdram and Ebola. Thanks for downloading. See you tomorrow.
Small details or big surfaces, tight corners or odd shapes, flat, rounded, textured, or tall. Whatever your next project, there's a spray paint pattern that's just right. Because Rust-Oleum's new Custom Spray 5-in-1 gives you control with 5 different spray patterns. So you can tackle nooks, crannies, edges, and curves without worrying about drips, runs, uneven coverage, or anything else. Custom Spray 5-in-1. Only from Rust-Oleum.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.